The Burnley sensation, as it was now becoming known, had caused a great stir not only in Burnley, but also that of Manchester. And not even the hustle and bustle of daily life could conceal the fact that something of unusual importance was about to take place. And on Friday the 6th of October 1893, Minshull Police Court in Manchester will be the setting of what was quickly escalating into the crime of the decade. The public's appetite for curiosity had been whetted by recent rumours that sensational new evidence had been found that would incriminate both Ashworth Reed and Elizabeth Remington for the willful murder of a child, and as people made their way to the courthouse, the only topic of conversation on their lips was, were they innocent or were they guilty of murder? Minshull Street Police Station was already packed with groups of people all eager to see the lurid details of the case hours before the trial had started, and as soon as the doors were opened, the spacious corridors and staircases leading to the court were quickly filled and the limited allocation of seats provided for the public gallery would soon be occupied. As the morning advanced, more and more people all made their way to the courthouse. This was a case that no one wanted to miss. Taken to their seats, members of the press were first into the courthouse, but seats were at a premium. Those unlucky enough to arrive late argued with officials, with pushing and shoving taking hold as tempers flared. Next, the police officials involved in the case would make their appearance. Chief Detective Inspector Caminada flitted in and out of the room, seemingly making sure all of his members of staff were ready. Showing an air of authority, he was described by one journalist as being a pleasant-looking, dark-haired, bearded man with an open face and intellectual expression. With everyone now in place, the only people next to attend the session were those of Ashworth Reed and Elizabeth Remington. However, Mr. William Corbett, prosecuting on behalf of the police, would attend, and he would ask the judge that the case against Reed and Remington may be called in order that he might make an application for a remand. Now at this point, the members of the press looked around, stunned at what they were hearing. Nothing was known to any of them, and the request for remand seemed literally to come out of nowhere. A hush came over the gallery as the name Reed was made out. A few seconds later, and the footsteps of newcomers into the court could be heard making their way into the dock. Standing with their heads bent down, Reed and Remington appeared to the wide-eyed open spectators, all yearning for the details of their crimes to be heard in detail for the very first time. Elizabeth was a well-built, tall-looking young woman, and it was clearly obvious to all that she had been crying for some considerable time. Each time she wiped away tears from her face, more appeared just as quickly. Her face was slightly obscured by a hat trimmed with velvet, relieved by a small feather, and the upper portion of her body was covered in a grey-looking shawl, and that seemed to cover her neck and jawline. Stood next to her was Ashworth Reed, dressed in a smart-looking brown suit that gave the impression of a successful businessman with an aura of authority. His thin, shallow face was partially covered with a long beard, and it seemed that recent events had given him a haggard appearance. Approaching the bench, William Corbett said, "I appear in this case to prosecute. The prisoners are charged with the murder of the child of the female prisoner. They were brought to you a week ago today and remanded in custody." He would then go on to say to the judge, Mr. Heedlam, "They were brought before the bench and remanded in custody. I apply today for a further remand for a week, on the ground that the case is not yet complete. Important inquiries are now on foot, which may result in the discovery of a material character, and it is not yet desirable at the present time that I should state the case more fully than Chief Detective Inspector Caminada stated a week ago." Based on this request, Reed and Remington would be remanded until Thursday, 11th of October, and the case would resume at around 11:30 a.m. On this news, the court quickly emptied to the disappointment of all those that had attended. The cases that were next to be heard were seemingly less important to the public to that of Reed and Remington's. A week later, and just as previously, the Minshull Police Court was packed to the rafters by the time Reed and Remington made their way into the dock on the 11th of October 1893. No fewer than 18 witnesses would be called for, as the full story of what had transpired on the afternoon of 6th of August 1893 and to the discovery of the body of a baby being found by the Shorrock brothers was read out. William Corbett, prosecuting, would give details of the case that we have already talked about in the first episode of this two-part story. He would tell the jury the story of how Elizabeth had given birth to a baby boy, whose father, it was claimed, was Ashworth Reed, and that they had taken the baby to a river in Blakely, where they then murdered the child before disposing the body beneath some bushes. He would go into detail as to how the couple had originally met, and how Elizabeth had left the Reed's employment before moving to Manchester, where she then resided until she had given birth. He would also go on to tell of the meetings between the pair at Angel Meadow, and how they had planned the murder of their then unborn child. He would also mention her signed statement, which he produced as evidence and handed over to the judge, Mr. Heedlam, as well as the ring Elizabeth had given to Caminada whilst at the Manchester Town Hall where she was taken to. Frances Remington would be next to take to the stand, and again, she would go into great detail as to the events leading up to and after Elizabeth left for Manchester prior to giving birth to her son. Victor Saul, surgeon who had helped Elizabeth on arrival at the Temperance Hotel on Newbridge Street, as well as Mary King, landlady of the Temperance Hotel, would also be next to give evidence. But one of the most important witnesses, however, was that of John Stone, a detective officer who was in the employment of the Lancashire and Yorkshire Railway Company, who said he knew both the prisoners and had seen them together at Victoria Station at least half a dozen times, one in particular being in the subway, and on another occasion in either refreshment room of platform number 6. It also seemed to be midday on each occasion, and the first time he noticed them was around the end of June. Another important witness was that of William Gordon, caretaker of St Michael's Flags Recreation Ground, Angel Meadow. He first saw them around the end of May sitting together on one of the benches. It was also midday and they were deep in conversation. He would say that he saw them make regular visits and would usually stay for around an hour, sometimes much longer. They always arrived together and left by the Ashley Lane gate. He would bring this to the attention of his friend James Bartholomew, verger of St Michael's Church, and he too would recognise the pair. 12-year-old Alfred Shorrocks, the boy who first found the body, would also be called to the bench. Here he would give evidence of the events of August the 6th. Many other witnesses were called: PC Baker, Thomas Pickles, who was the manager working for Ashworth Reed, Mary and James Law, landlords of the British Queen Hotel on Baker Road, Todmorden, Ellen Jenkins, waitress at the Central Temperance Hotel, also in Todmorden, and finally Sarah Ann Earnshaw, a resident of Baker Road, who said she had seen both Elizabeth and Ashworth pass her house on the 7th of August. Judge Heedlam, having heard enough for the day, would remand the prisoners until Friday the 20th of October. The third and final trial to take place at the Minshull Police Court would commence a week later. Sidney Smelt, deputy coroner for the city, would be called for. It would state on record that on August the 7th, he had held an inquest on the body of the male child, name unknown. He would mention the evidence of Dr. Young, who acted for the divisional police surgeon, who published details of the appearance of the body. Smelt would also say that the jury came to the conclusion that death was caused by internal convulsions and returned a verdict of death from natural causes. Now, this is something that will prove vital in the defence of both Reed and Remington. At the summing up, both prisoners will be formally charged for trial at the Manchester Assizes at the next possible date. On the 23rd of November 1893, the trial of both Ashworth Reed and Elizabeth Remington would officially begin. However, the trial wouldn't take place at the Manchester Assizes. Instead, it would take place at the Liverpool Assizes, and after having charges of both willfully murdering a male child and abetting the disposal of said child, both prisoners pleaded not guilty. Again, the same witnesses as those we've already spoken about would give evidence. However, and most importantly, Chief Detective Inspector Caminada would again take to the stand, and this, along with the evidence given by Dr. Young, surgeon who performed the postmortem on the body, would prove to be the most influential for the defence team as well as the jury. Caminada would go over the details on the day of both arrests of Reed and Remington. He would read out the statement Elizabeth had made whilst being held at the Manchester Town Hall on the day of her arrest. But Sir Edward Clarke, defending Reed, would say, "This is not evidence against my client." Caminada would be asked, "Is it usual before prisoners make a statement to caution them?" To which Caminada replied, "No, sir." Mr. H.G. Shee, defending Elizabeth, asked Caminada, "You don't make a practice then of telling them they are not obliged to make a statement, but that if they do so, it may be given as evidence against them?" Caminada replied, "I don't know that I ever got a statement without cautioning them." But she would argue, saying, "I don't observe anywhere in your depositions, Caminada, that you said you cautioned her. There is nowhere in your depositions any written statement that you cautioned her." In what turned out to be a feisty interrogation, she would push Caminada as hard as he could. "You say in your depositions she gave me a ring. I showed this to Reed and he said it's safer or better for me to say nothing. When you showed this ring to Reed, you expected Reed to make a statement, didn't you?" Caminada couldn't answer as she interrupted him on more than one occasion. She would keep going back to Elizabeth's statements, each time twisting his words to hopefully catch Caminada off guard. In summing up, she would argue that Caminada had failed to follow police guidelines and that all of his evidence was, to put simply, irrelevant. "I submit that there is internal evidence from the document itself that it is not possible such words could have been used by her," she would have said. The clerk of the courtroom then read out Elizabeth's statement, of which she had dismissed as being as evidence. Upon finishing it, the judge facing the jury would say, "This is not evidence in any degree as against the prisoner Reed. You must not consider it in dealing with this case." Basically meaning all the evidence pointing to Reed as being the person responsible for the death of the baby boy was now irrelevant. Eventually, Sir Edward Clark, defending, would say to the judge, "Do you think, my lord, that there is evidence against Reed to go before the jury?" The judge turned again to the jury, saying, "There is no evidence whatsoever upon which a jury could act." The jury, at the direction of the judge, would spend a little over a minute before making their decision. Standing up, the foreman of the jury read out, "The jury are unanimously of opinion that there is not sufficient evidence to find a verdict of guilty." Mr. Shee would go on to face the judge. "With respect to my client, I submit that there is no evidence whatsoever that this child did not die naturally." But as Mr. Shee was about to address the jury, the foreman stood up and intimated that the jury had also decided to return in a verdict of not guilty against Remington. Both Reed and Remington were formally discharged and left the dock as a free man and a free woman, but the sudden termination of the case was received with great surprise and bemusement. Shocked crowds outside hooted and yelled as Reed made his way out of court. At the Manchester Royal Exchange, more crowds had gathered as they caught a glimpse of him making his way to a private office that had been cleared for him. Emotions were high and they jostled to get closer to him. Later that evening, the crowd still hadn't dispersed, and when Reed finally left the office to make his way into Barton Arcade, which was situated across the street, they followed him, still shouting obscenities and spitting in his direction. The next day, both Reed and Remington made their way back to Burnley on the Thursday evening. Elizabeth looked pale and seemed anxious, as well as becoming exhausted. However, she had spoken with one journalist on her way home, thanking those that stood behind her throughout her ordeal. Interestingly, when asked if she ever thought she would be discharged, she replied saying, "No, I expected we both should have been sentenced to a term of imprisonment." It was also reported that she volunteered other statements regarding her own confession to Caminada, but because of the verdicts of not guilty being made, the press refused to publish these new confessions. So in the end, it seems that both Ashworth Reed and Elizabeth Remington had gotten away with murder. Reed being the one to kill the child, with Remington being an accessory to the fact. Her own statement to Caminada, which clearly outlined what happened on the day in question, was ruled out as irrelevant simply because there was no record of Caminada reading out the rights to Elizabeth prior to making her statement. All of the witnesses who came forward to say that they had seen both Reed and Remington meeting up for several weeks before the baby's body was found, that was also ruled out as being irrelevant, as was the post-mortem report that said that the baby looked to have died from asphyxia or convulsions and therefore natural causes. Now, I'm no lawyer and certainly not clued up on how postmortems work, but in this case it really does seem that money and stature over the life of a defenceless baby boy came first. So what are your thoughts on this? Was the right verdict made? Did Caminada fail in his duties, and should he have known better? Or did the two people come up with a plan to get rid of a baby simply because it would bring shame on Ashworth Reed? And ultimately, did they get away with murder? I'd be interested to know. So thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this story. And if you want more, please show some support and comment down below, especially if you are listening to this from my website. You can also follow me on Twitter and on Instagram, which the links are down below. But in the meantime, take care, and I will be back soon with another tale from the past.